Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. Today, a glimpse into what it may be like to live with a diagnosis of bipolar disorder. We welcome back New York Times bestselling author Lisa Genova to talk about her new book, More or Less Maddie. Hi, Lisa. So good to see you.
Hi, Mindy. So good to see you, too.
So I think a lot of folks know this, but your novels focus on brain science inspired by neurological conditions. We had Alzheimer's, traumatic brain injury, autism, Huntington's disease, and ALS. This book looks at bipolar disorder. So you use your training as a neuroscientist to not only help us understand these conditions more, but it's more than the science we see. We see the human condition. So this is the first time that you're writing about a condition that's classified as a mental illness. So talk about that and what led you to choose bipolar disorder for this book.
Yes. So I began all of this with Alzheimer's because my grandmother had Alzheimer's, and I, as the neuroscientist in my family, had been tasked with understanding it so that we could better take care of her. And I read everything I could about it, and I read textbooks, scientific papers, books by caregivers, and everything was helpful to a point. But what I recognized was, while I felt really bad for her and heartbroken for her, and frustrated and embarrassed and confused, it was all sympathy. I didn't know how to feel with her. I was too uncomfortable around her Alzheimer's to really stay with her in her reality and feel with her. And that's empathy. That's what was missing for me. And I recognized that everything that I read was nonfiction and written by an outsider. So a scientist, a clinician, a caregiver. And I thought, oh, isn't that interesting? Fiction is a place where we can walk in someone else's shoes. Fiction is a great vehicle for empathy. And so that was the seed for what became Still Alice. And so I've kept going because I think that there's a special kind of fear and taboo that is carried with anything going on from the neck up. So if you've got anything going on with your brain, it makes it really hard for people who aren't familiar with it to sort of stay with you. They get scared, embarrassed, uncomfortable. And the quickest way for people to relieve that discomfort is they look away. And so oftentimes folks with brain disorders, brain diseases, not only are they living with something really difficult, but then they get this added burden of being alienated and isolated and excluded from community. So this is what I do. Mm-hmm. And I knew I wanted to go and tackle mental illness next. And it's so interesting to me, Mindy, that there are certain brain conditions, disorders, you know, illnesses of the brain that are called and carved out as mental illness, and it's arbitrary, it's made up. So we take things like depression, schizophrenia, anxiety disorders, and bipolar disorder, and they're clumped into a separate category, and we call them mental illness, but there's no biological basis for that categorization. And it's interesting because, right, we don't call Alzheimer's disease a mental illness. Right. And yet, bipolar disorder, which is also it's a deregulation of certain brain processes, we call it a mental illness. And I think that terminology isn't really serving anyone. There's an added layer of distrust and dismissiveness and fear when what you have is called mental illness. And I chose bipolar disorder because I think it's pervasive. I think it's hiding in plain sight everywhere. The statistics are something like, they vary, but it's about 1 in 50 people. So 2% of the population. And yet it has to be underrepresented because you have to come from a certain level of privilege to navigate the healthcare system to get to a bipolar diagnosis. So there's a lot of people out there living with this and not talking about it. And so I thought a story could be a helpful way for people to become familiar with it enough to be comfortable, have empathy, and be invited into an open conversation about it.
Yeah. So for folks who don't know what bipolar disorder is, tell us what it is. I mean, at one time, I think they called it manic depressive disorder, then they changed it to bipolar. So what is bipolar disorder?
Yeah, I mean, it's had a long history of being called all kinds of things. Like way back, you know, it was you were possessed by a demon, or you were a witch, or you had a wandering uterus, or like you have, you know, an imbalance of fluids, and we're going to, you know, let your blood through leeches. But so bipolar disorder, as it's called today, is an impairment in your brain's ability to regulate things like mood, emotion, energy, sleep and circadian rhythm, and thought. And so we have these sort of two poles that people swing between. So if you become manic, you're deregulating in energy and mood in one direction. So you're becoming very revved up. You might not need any sleep at all or very little sleep. And you're never tired. You often have grandiose thoughts. You're amazing at everything. You're super talented. And this in your mind, you're super talented. You might not actually be. So you might start projects and jump from one project to the next. It's called flight of ideas. You have pressured speech and racing thoughts. So you're talking really fast and you're interrupting and you're probably texting and calling people all night long. You don't feel there are any consequences to your actions because everything you do is perfect and amazing. So you might engage in a lot of risky behaviors. So you might be drinking and doing drugs excessively. You might be having sex with multiple partners, even if you're in a committed relationship. You're spending thousands of dollars that you might not have. You're booking flights to places in the world and taking off. You decide you're going to be the next, Gucci, or you're going to be a race car driver, or you're going to be an astronaut. So it can be very chaotic. On the other end is depression, and so this isn't just a bummed out, feeling bad kind of period. It can last for a long time. It can last for months and months on end, where you don't enjoy anything you used to enjoy. You feel hopeless and worthless and like lack energy. It's very difficult to move and get showered and dressed and engage with your life. It can feel so hopeless and so miserable. And it's not just a psychogenic pain, it could be a very physical pain. In both states, you can have something called a mixed state. So, mania, people often think it's euphoric, and it can be to a point, but you can feel agitated and irritated and angry when in either state. So, when you're manic and you're like that, you can become violent. And when you're depressed, that's if you're feeling agitated and you're having a mixed state, that's when you might have enough energy to try and end your life. And that's the state when when someone has bipolar disorder and they're depressed and in a mixed state, it's the state they fear the most. It is the worst feeling, and it is the scariest. It is what scares the loved ones the most too, because that's when we're at risk of losing them.
Right. So your character, Maddie Banks, she is a college freshman at NYU. She's been diagnosed with bipolar disorder. Tell us a little bit more about Maddie and this. And it's not uncommon for this to be diagnosed in adolescence or a little later, right? So Maddie had a pretty much normal childhood, right?
Yeah, and that's what I learned from the research is that onset of this disorder is typically late teens to early 20s. And so, yeah, she's lived a quote unquote normal life. That's what she's always been striving for. That was the way to fit in and make life easy, was to be a quote normal kid. She grew up in suburban Connecticut. Her dad left when she was 4 years old, so she doesn't really remember much about him. Turns out he probably had bipolar disorder, but was never diagnosed. But so yeah, she's just finished her freshman year at NYU. She's sort of questioning a culture's pressure on young people to strive for a perfect and quote normal life. Like, she's supposed to go to college, find a major, get a job, get married, buy the house, have the kids, like do all of those things. Her older sister, who's 5 years older, is doing all of those things quite, seemingly effortlessly. So she's having a hard time. Her boyfriend broke up with her twice. She's finding the schoolwork much harder than high school. She hasn't really found her circle of friends. So she's definitely feeling depressed that first year, but she doesn't label it and doesn't seek help. She gets home for the summer and routine is in place again. She's going to bed at the same time every night. She has a job. She's exercising. She's getting, three meals a day because mom is now cooking, and she's back together with the boyfriend. So she feels better and the summer goes well. She gets back to school in the fall, and everything is still good in her life, but she feels depressed again, and it's worse than the last time. It is heavier, it's darker. She's having a hard time focusing and learning. And in fact, she gets a letter from the dean's office saying that if she doesn't bring her grades up, she's at risk of being asked to leave NYU. So she, in a sort of panic, goes to the health center to get an excuse and an extension on a paper that's due. And she gets that, but she also gets a prescription for an antidepressant. And because what's in her brain is bipolar disorder and not unipolar depression, an antidepressant will catapult you, and it catapults her into her first manic episode. And so begins this journey that she's going to have of being diagnosed and living with bipolar disorder and how it shakes up. Like, she's a young person just trying to figure out who she is. It's really when you start to form your identity. And here comes this diagnosis that's so massive. And bipolar is saying, this is who you are. You are bipolar. And so I think most of the story is about her trying to parse out the distinction between I am bipolar and I have bipolar.
And you mentioned her sister, Emily, who is seemingly perfect, right? She's doing everything that she's expected to do. And Emily and her mother, Maddie's mother as well, have this really great relationship. She's like a mini of her mom. And that's another struggle that Maddie has, is she sees this relationship that Emily has with her mother that she doesn't quite have. She doesn't feel the same way. And that creates another stress on her.
Yeah, I mean, she's always sort of felt left out, like she wasn't quite.
Oh, Lisa, we just lost you for a second there. Not sure what
Oh
happened.
gosh.
Oh, there, now you're back. Okay, sorry.
Am I back? I'm sorry. So, when I write these stories, it's never just about the neurological condition. It has to be about our shared human condition. Like, I'm going to get all of this education in for you. I did lots and lots of research. It's in there, but it's in service of story, so it shouldn't feel heavy-handed. And the story really is a lot about, what is a normal life for a young woman, and who are we okay to, who what is okay to be. So she, Maddie, hasn't really felt like she's fit in, and she's trying to go along with it. Like, she goes to the her mother and stepfather belong to a fancy country club, and she doesn't really like being there. She's sort of looking around, thinking, is this what a successful life looks like? Is this all there is? Is this what I'm supposed to do? And sort of the idea of if she chooses something outside of what culture is expecting of a young woman, is that allowed? Is that okay? Will she be called crazy if she decides she wants to be a stand-up comedian instead of, majoring in English at NYU? So, the story is really, it plays around a lot with that.
No, that human condition is absolutely great. And I want to talk a little bit about that stand-up comedy stuff, but we're going to take a break first. We're talking with Lisa Genova. Her new book is More or Less Maddie. 866-999-4626 is our number, our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll have more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking with New York Times bestselling author Lisa Genova about her new book, More or Less Maddie, which focuses on bipolar disorder. 866-999-4626 is our number, our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. So Maddie's obsessed with a couple of things. We'll get to comedy in a second. But first, I want to mention Taylor Swift, because like a lot of the young people, she is a fan, uber fan of Taylor Swift. And that plays a big role in the book.
Yeah, so it the deep dive into Taylor actually begins for her at the beginning of her first manic episode. So one of the things that can happen when you're manic is that you have delusions. You believe things that aren't real. Your thought becomes detached and deregulated from reality. And so she starts to believe that she is going to write Taylor Swift's memoir. And they're going to collaborate together, and she's going to tour with her so that she can, follow Taylor around and write this memoir on the road. There are more delusions having to do with Taylor whenever she's manic, and it sets her off. She at one point believes she's going to open for Taylor as a comedian, and she's supposed to collaborate with her at her home in Rhode Island. So yeah, when people are manic, they often believe that they are very special in some way. They take cues from the world and believe that it's personalized for them in a very grandiose way. So they're meant to, be a political leader or the president of something or start a rock band or know someone famous or they are someone famous. And so for her, because she's this young girl from suburban Connecticut, I thought Taylor was the perfect thing for her to become attached to when
So
she was
many people
manic.
are, obsessed with Taylor, right? So
Yes.
she is also drawn to stand-up comedy, and it's not easy, as you know, to be a stand-up
Right.
comedian. And I wondered how you were going to be able to write about that from a comedian's point of view. And of course, you interviewed comedians, as I figured you would. But I read
Yes.
in the acknowledgments that you actually took a stand-up comedy writing class and did a
Yes,
5-minute set.
I did.
So
Yes, I
tell
take
us
my
about
homework
that.
very seriously. Yeah, so the first t she stumbles into a comedy club during her first manic episode and ends up loving it there, and she starts hooking up with comedians, and she decides she's while she's also interested in Taylor in the state, she also believes that Netflix has hired her to write a 1-hour comedy special, and she writes about 500 pages handwritten of quote comedy. When she's over the manic episode and she's now depressed and home, she finds those notebooks and flips through them, and it's mostly nonsense and not funny, and in fact often mean. She's making sort of jokes about her family and her mother, and they're not funny at all. But she finds a few that are, and it sparks an interest in her that turns out to be real. And the family has a hard time disentangling the manic episode from this genuine interest. They think that while Taylor Swift an intense interest in Taylor Swift might be a warning signal to everyone that uh-oh, she's going to start to swing to mania. We need to circle the wagons and get her some help. They also think that an interest in comedy might be that as well, which it is not. So comedy turns out to be a real interest for her. So yes, I interviewed a lot of comedians at various levels. So I interviewed Amy Schumer and Maria Bamford. Maria Bamford also has bipolar disorder. She's quite open about it. She's got a great comedy special called Weakness is the Brand. It's on Amazon Prime, I believe. And so they were fantastic about telling me how they got to where they are. I interviewed a woman named Shayma Tash. She's out in Las Vegas. She's a resident comedian there. She does several hundred shows a year. And then a lot of newer comedians living in New York who are pounding the pavement, like just getting started. So that was super helpful. And then, yes, one of the things I did in this book is I'm writing stand-up comedy. I'm giving you various sets for Maddie. And so I had to figure out how to do that because I'm not a comedy writer. And I knew that I also wanted to end this book with what would be Maddie's 5-minute set and using. We humans often do use humor to connect over difficult and uncomfortable subjects. And a lot of comedians also use comedy as a way to help understand themselves. And it turns out whatever's going on with you is also probably relatable to other people. So she's going to use that comedy to better understand herself with bipolar disorder. So yes, it was hard, and the 5-minute set was terrifying, but
Was
I
like,
did it.
were you,
And I
you must have
asked,
been a nervous wreck going up there,
yeah.
though.
So I did ask when I started the class, I asked the teacher, I actually didn't even ask. I said, look, so I'm doing this for a character that I'm writing. So I'm actually going to take this class as a 21-year-old. And all my jokes are going to be written from her point of view. And actually, quite thankfully, he said, no, you're not doing that. You're going to take this as you, and you're going to have to trust that whatever you learn will apply to your character. And I was like, oh, crap. Like, I have to actually write my own comedy. So I will tell everyone I did give exactly one of my jokes from my 5-minute set to Maddie. It was the very first one about thongs. And then the rest of the comedy I wrote for Maddie in the book.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So just one more question about your set. You went up there, you did your 5-minute set. What was the reaction? And did you have anybody in the audience on purpose?
Yeah, so it was a little bit of a cheat because it was during the end of the pandemic, so we couldn't do it live. It was over Zoom. So we had a good size audience. I could see the people in the bubbles, but yeah, I had a lot of my Cape Cod girlfriends there for support. Actually, the three women that I thank in the acknowledgement, Sarah, Kim, and Katie, they were there. My parents were there, which was a little funny because, like, oh, sorry, Mom. So some
It's
of it was,
comedy.
yeah.
So while the story is fiction, you have to get the facts right. And it's what you call informed fiction. Talk a little bit about the research.
Yeah, so I'm always trying to tell the truth under the imagined circumstances. So I read as many books as I could about bipolar disorder, a lot of textbooks, a lot of memoir. And then I sought out really the world's thought leaders in bipolar research and treatment. And these were psychiatrists and psychologists. From Mass General, California, Pennsylvania, Australia, South Africa, like it spanned the globe. And then I came to know the real experts, which are the people who live with bipolar. So I came to know a dozen people with bipolar disorder. Interestingly, not all of them wanted to be thanked in the acknowledgments. That's how much stigma is attached to this. And their loved ones, and then loved ones of other folks with bipolar disorder. So I really, I it, these were intense conversations, super vulnerable, really generous. People were sharing with me, the scariest, most vulnerable, often embarrassing, chaotic moments of their lives. And it really helped me understand the felt experience of this.
Is there a spectrum, with this disorder? Like, are there some folks who maybe don't get to the point, like Maddie, that with the delusions that she's going to do Netflix and all of that, or is it pretty much everybody has bipolar has very similar symptoms?
No, there are two classified kinds, and again, this is just made up. It's not there's no blood test or brain scan that gets us to a distinction, but it's a useful way to talk about it. So there's bipolar one and bipolar two. So I gave Maddie the more severe form of this, bipolar one, because in fiction you should always raise the stakes as high as possible whenever possible. So in bipolar one, you have mania that's a full-blown mania. You will have these psychosis symptoms. You will have delusions or hallucinations or both. Bipolar two, you have what we call hypomania. It's like mania light. You don't ever scale up to that full-blown hallucinations and delusions. So it's often a very hypomania can often be a very productive state to be in. It can be. It can also be destructive as well, but it can be that you're just really revved up. You have tons of energy. You don't really need any sleep and you're not tired for, maybe weeks on end. And if you're talented at something, if you're not like, if you don't, if you're not plagued with a flight of ideas where you're just skipping from one topic to the next to the next, if you're an artist, you might feel so confident and have like the guardrails are down and you have your editor is taking a break and you're just able to create and create and you're not tired and you can be very productive and prolific in that state. People often love hypomania. The problem is there's usually a price to pay on the other side of things, which is the depression, which is so brutal, it is never worth the price of playing that poker game.
I found it interesting that I could identify with Maddie's experiences and, of course, feel empathy for her struggle, but I could equally feel that same empathy for her mother.
Oh, I'm so glad.
I mean, because I mean, I guess because, when you are a mother, you go, what would you do? What would you do in this situation? And a lot of which what mom is doing might be a little considered a little overkill, certainly from Maddie's
Controlling.
perspective, right? Yeah, very controlling. But you want to protect your daughter, right? So I felt empathy and I could feel for both experiences.
So a few things happen when if your teenager is diagnosed with this or your 20-year-old. So from the this book is told from Maddie's point of view. So we're in a close third point of view. And so she's 20. She's at an age where like, don't tell me what to do is like under the best of circumstances. But now, mom has lived through this with her first husband, so she knows how scary and destructive it can be. She does not want this to happen to her daughter. So at first it's a bit of denial. Like that first conversation with that first psychiatrist is like, well, all teenagers are depressed, aren't they? Like all teenagers are moody. Like don't put this label and this burden on my kid. And then once the diagnosis is in place, her mother is hovering a bit. Have you taken your meds? Where are you? What are you doing? Is this safe for you? There's a level of distrust that happens with everyone. So Maddie doesn't even trust herself. She's, how happy am I allowed to get? How excited am I allowed to get before I have to worry it's a symptom of an impending manic episode? How sad or bummed out or disappointed am I allowed to be before I have to worry that it's a symptom of illness? And then same with everybody else. If she's a little revved up, like, is it a problem? So there's a level of how do we trust you now? And then, yeah, mom is also worried about what culture thinks of her daughter. She knows that the world is going to judge her kid for this if they know this is what she has. So there's at one point the mother's saying, like Maddie says, mother's asking, what are you up to? Where are you? And she says, oh, I'm reading a book at Starbucks. And she says, oh, I hope it's not that book I sent you on bipolar disorder. Don't read that in public. We don't want people to know. She doesn't want the grandmother to know because she thinks it would break her grandmother's heart. And so that's another thing that happens with this illness that I've talked to so many people is that there's a level of secrecy that everybody wants you to be in on, but secrecy breeds shame, right? Secrecy is a recipe for shame, and shame is just another. It's an unnecessary burden that folks live with bipolar disorder. This disorder is hard enough without layering on shame.
There
Yeah,
was
but they go through that in this family. They have to find their way.
It's interesting that Maddie's reluctant to tell her new friends in the comedy world there, especially her friend Max, about her diagnosis. Again, afraid she'll be judged. And when she does, she finds out he already said, "Oh yeah, I already kind of figured that out."
Yeah, I love that for her because again, I think that there's this sense that I have to hide this or people won't accept me and people won't love me. And yet I have found even in the 1 week that this book has been out that it's this book has been an invitation for people to talk about it. It has given permission for people to say, well, this is my son is going through this now, or my wife had this, or my dad had this. And I've not once seen people recoil from that. It has brought people together. It has invited hugs and connection. So for Max, this young comedian, he just sort of figured when she was in the middle of a manic episode when they met, and then they have a bit of a relationship ongoing. And when she finally confesses it to him, he's just like, yeah, when I met you, I figured you were either manic or on cocaine. And when you didn't turn out to be, a coke addict, I was like, oh, it must have been mania. No big deal. So I think that a lot of young people in particular are more comfortable accepting and talking about mental health and mental illness. And wouldn't it be wonderful if everybody could be like Max in that situation? Yeah.
Another conversation about it that that stands out to me in the book is when Emily is talking to Maddie about this, and Emily's older. She remembers their father, and she is also feeling empathetic for her mother, going, well, mom went through this. It's kind of like she doesn't want to have to go through this again. I was like, wow, there's another big burden that poor Maddie has to deal with.
Yeah, it's like Maddie, it's Christmas time, everyone's home, and Maddie has been asked to hide her bipolar disorder from the grandmother, and she tells her sister, she's like, I think mom is ashamed of me. And Emily says, no, I think she's just really scared. Like, this is what happened with dad. Don't you remember? Don't you remember? Like, he would come home and it was a lot of yelling and it was scary and all the boats in the front yard. Like, they didn't live on the water, but they had a front lawn full of all these boats he would buy when he was manic. And Maddie's like, yeah, I remembered the boats being there, but she didn't remember why. Like, she didn't remember how chaotic it was. And then the dad took off and they don't know if he's dead or alive. They don't know anything about him. So it's just the first moment that Maddie sort of takes a step outside of herself and sees that this is happening not just to her, it's happening to her whole family.
So we talked a little bit about both the manic side and the depressive side. Maddie has a really difficult time seeing her self-worth in these moments, and there are lots of thoughts about suicide. And I'm guessing that this is common with that type of bipolar disorder because the depression is so deep. Maddie also, this was a hard part to read for, in the book for me to read. She does take to cutting. And I think that's so hard for people to understand what drives somebody to do that.
Yeah. Yes. So in talking to people who have bipolar disorder, this was common and people shared it with me. And again, part of me wanted to shy away from it and not write that because it is upsetting. And I knew that it would in fact be maybe triggering for some folks. And yet I am committed to, in all of my books, I'm not going to Pollyanna sugarcoat. I'm going to be unflinching in my quest for telling the truth. And because this came up over and over again in my interviews with folks, I knew I wanted to and needed to include it. And what I learned is that the cutting is, it's a way of making physical and sort of manifesting in physical form the pain that they feel internally. And it almost feels like a release and a relief a bit. It's sort of like it's a pressure valve. So the pain is just so intense and so massive, but they can't sort of see where it's coming from. Mm-hmm. And so to cause a bit of pain and to sort of feel that release. And also people talked about like seeing, strangely, like seeing a little bit of blood. It was a moment of like, oh, I am real. Like I'm alive. But I feel dead. Mm-hmm. I'm in so much pain. I feel almost like I'm not human. And this is like, okay, I feel a bit of relief here. It's a very strange thing to understand if you don't have that impulse to do it.
Yeah.
But it was a compulsion that most people shared that they had.
As upsetting as it is to read, I'm glad you included it because I think it also points to the desperation that she feels, right? I mean, I think it makes you understand a little more about the place she's in when it's in those dark moments.
Yeah. And it's a moment like it's almost like an obsession. She like when she wants to do it and can't get to a place where she can cut herself, but then she finally can. There's that moment of sweet relief and numbness that then she gets sort of swaddled in. But then after it, when that experience is over and she's left with the scar on her, on the mm-hmm. inside of her forearm, she's left with so much shame again. Like, oh, now I have to hide this.
Right.
Because if anybody knows I'm doing this, this is evidence that there's something wrong with me. So yeah, the cutting is really tough for her.
Yeah. We're talking with Lisa Genova. Her new book is More or Less Maddie. 866-999-4626 is our number. If you'd like to join our conversation, that's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll have more after a break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking with Lisa Genova. Her new book is More or Less Maddie, which focuses on bipolar disorder. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Before we get back to the story and Maddie, I want to just touch on your history. Neuroscientist, you decide, yeah, no, I'm going to write books now. I know we've asked you this before, but people wondering, why did you make that change? Why did you decide, I'm going to write books about this instead of actually continue my career as a neuroscientist?
Yeah. Well, I alluded to it earlier. It was my grandmother who had Alzheimer's. So it was really trying to understand the felt experience and not just intellectual information. So I could read about the science and read about the clinical disease management and even read about caregiving. And that was helpful, but it wasn't about what it felt like to be her. I didn't know how to join her in her reality and experience her from a place of empathy. I only felt bad for her. It was sympathy. Mm-hmm. And so fiction was the place to do that. And I took a chance. I said, yeah. Well, that novel at the time didn't exist. Yeah. Well, what if I write it? What if I write a story about a woman with Alzheimer's and tell it from her perspective? And once, so I did that, and I follow the same procedure with all of my books. I read everything, and I interview everyone who's involved in that experience, and then I leap into fiction from there. And because Still Alice worked so well, I mean, it took a while for I self-published it, right. Sold it out of the trunk of my car on Cape Cod.
I remember that, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So once it got up into the hands of Simon and Schuster and out of the trunk of my car, and I saw, the impact story can have on folks, and that it is so much more accessible. It is, people aren't going to pick up a memoir or a scientific paper on Alzheimer's or Huntington's or bipolar disorder if it doesn't affect their lives. And even if it does, it might be too overwhelming to dive into a lot of that kind of reading. But they might read a novel. Novels are really accessible to folks. Stories are a place where we can comfortably walk in someone else's shoes who might be very different from us and experience what it feels like to be them. And that's powerful. If it's not just intellectual information, it's the emotional information, it's the felt experience that really inspires us to change.
All right. So we talked a little bit about the highs and the lows that can happen. So what triggers them? And for Maddie, the first time it's the antidepressants that do that. But generally speaking, how are families told this is what you need to watch for?
Yeah, it's different for different people. I would say one of the hallmark signs and triggers that also becomes a symptom once you're in it is a disruption in sleep. So if you are suddenly not getting much sleep for some reason, if you take a transatlantic flight and miss a night's sleep, or if you have a lot of exams coming up and you're staying up really late and you only got 5 hours of sleep last night, anytime you compromise sleep, that is, you need to watch out because you might start to deregulate sleep. And so then if you start to deregulate sleep, like, oh, now I'm only getting 4 hours a night and I'm not tired, like that's a sign that you're heading into a manic episode. But it can be like people watch. So there are apps now, and I included one in the book for Maddie to use, like a mood app. There are ways that you can keep track of certain behaviors and what's going on, like just your day-to-day mood and your day-to-day energy. How many hours of sleep did you get last night? How many texts did you send in a day? So if I normally send 20 texts a day, but all of a sudden I sent 50 texts or I sent no texts, like am I behaving in a way that would signify that I'm heading toward a depression or a mania? And why that's important is because if you and your village of people, it's important to have people who are also observing you, because you will become an unreliable narrator as to what is going on once you're in it. To sort of raise your hand and say, I see the flags, I see a red flag, like let's circle the wagons, let's talk to your psychiatrist, let's get you in a conversation with your therapist and see if there's something we can do in terms of maybe we adjust your medications a bit, or we just watch out for you, and try and adjust things so that you stay within the range of normal. So it's are you, texting people all night long? Did you post 50 stories to your Instagram? Are you behaving in a way that is outside of what's normal? Are you talking about something that happens when you're manic? So are you starting to talk in a very special way about Taylor Swift? That's a sign. Are you calling in sick for work and you're not getting out of bed, or you're not showering? Like if there are things that suggest that you're heading toward depression, you as a community, as a village, decide along with your, ideally along in collaboration with your doctor, here are the constellation of symptoms and triggers we know for me, and let's all be on the lookout for them.
Talk about the medications, because there's always side effects with medication, right? And that's a and we see that in the story.
Yeah, I'm so glad you bring this up because this is one of the biggest things I learned, and I'm so appreciative of learning it. And I put this in the book in hopes that other people will come away with this too. So I think prior to doing all this research, when I would hear about someone who has bipolar disorder who had a manic episode or, did something really explosive or destructive and like, oh, they ended up hospitalized, the sort of next unspoken or spoken thing was judgmental. It was, oh, the thing that was said is, well, he went off his meds. And then the judgment is like, oh, okay, well, then he brought this on himself. It was like, oh, well, it's his fault then. And what I really want folks to appreciate is how difficult it is to stay on these meds and how reasonable it is to go off them, especially in the beginning of this journey. Like, Physicians all said it takes an average of 3 times going off the meds before a person finally commits to, all right, I'm as imperfect and horrible as the meds can be. That's a better situation for me, staying on them than going off. But here's why. So it's a few things. So the medications that are given for bipolar disorder are not designed for bipolar disorder. Okay. They are serendipitously discovered drugs for other illnesses being used for bipolar. And so what that means is it's very nonspecific. They act on receptors all over the brain. They're like promiscuous, is what we say. And as a result, you have a lot of side effects. And so the side effects can be you're nauseous every day. You're cognitively foggy, you have trouble thinking, you have a flat affect, so your facial expression doesn't change. You have a hand tremor, you have to pee all the time and you're always thirsty. You might have gained 50 pounds that cause weight gain. These are tough to live with. They really affect the quality of your day-to-day life. And so if you're, imagine you're Maddie. And you were diagnosed 6 months ago because you had a manic episode, and you haven't had a manic episode or a depressive episode since, which, by the way, might be in part because these meds are controlling your mood quite well. But it's 6 months ago, and there's no blood test or brain scan to diagnose this. It's diagnosed based on a conversation with a doctor you've never met before. And so, and talking to people who've been through this, I kind of liken it to pregnancy and childbirth, where you kind of forget how painful it was. And that's why we'll go on to have more than one kid. We're like, oh, I'll do that again. That wasn't so bad. So they look back on that first one and they'll think, was it really that bad? Like, did everybody? And by the way, your brain doesn't lay down memories very well when you're in a manic state. So you don't consolidate memories well to begin with. So your memory of that episode is going to be spotty. Maybe everyone overreacted. You know what? Yes, I wasn't sleeping well. I had insomnia and I was so overwhelmed and stressed. Like, yes, I had a bit of a breakdown, but maybe that was like a one-off thing. You know what? I'm going to try going off the meds and see how I do. Sounds perfectly reasonable to me. So my reaction now, if I hear that someone went off their meds, my reaction now would contain a whole lot more compassion and space for grace, where I would say something like, well, that makes sense that she tried doing that. Like, how is she now?
This was another point that struck me in the book. I love this. You write, "The language of this illness is a curious thing. Some people will say she has bipolar, while others will say she is bipolar. It's a subtle distinction in wording, a linguistic sleight of hand, but the difference in meaning feels significant."
And it is for her, and I think it is for most people. Like, language really matters. And so I found it really interesting. You know, we don't say, if you have Alzheimer's disease, we don't say, I don't say, I am Alzheimer's. I wouldn't say you are Alzheimer's. So again, this distinction between mental illness and other neurological illnesses, and they're all brain illnesses, they're all brain disorders. And yet we've carved out mental illness. And so we'll say, you are bipolar, you are depressed, you are schizophrenic. And, you know, we don't say you are ALS. We don't say you are a traumatic brain injury. So I thought that that was interesting and somewhat important because I think that if we label someone with this word, it becomes the sum total of who they are in some unspoken way. And that you are so much more than this disorder that you're living with. And so I really wanted that to be what the excerpt you read is the beginning of Maddie trying to parse out, like, wait, do I have to claim this as my identity or can it just be part of me? And so in her final 5 minute set, she goes into it in a bit of a funny way too. She's like, I had pizza last night, but I wasn't a pizza last night. Like, yeah, it's absurd almost if you compare it to other things. Like,
Really
you would
makes you
never
think.
say,
It makes you think about
yeah,
how you the words you use, right? And how you yeah,
exactly.
and how judgmental we can sound, even when we don't mean to, right?
No, yeah. Like, let's really be mindful of how we talk about this because there's an impact. Like, language really matters.
So I know the book's only been out for a week and you're on a book tour, but what's the reaction been? You talked about in some instances you're seeing people come together to talk about this. What's the reaction?
Yeah, I'm so thrilled. It's been exactly what I hoped for. It is inviting an open conversation. People are sharing their stories with me in the book signing lines. They're raising their hand in the Q&A and sharing it with a room full of strangers, like what is going on in their families. And people have messaged me and let me know that, like one woman said, in her whole life, she never imagined that people would talk openly and in public about bipolar disorder, and she got to be in the room when it happened. She said it was like one of her top life moments. So I just think there's a lot of healing that can happen when what you've had to keep secret is allowed to be spoken aloud. There's a such a relief of that burden.
Right. And also to just know, hey, I'm not alone. We're not the
Yeah,
only family
yeah.
dealing with this, right? Yeah.
Exactly. I think people are feeling seen and heard. And are able to know that this is, I'm not the only one dealing with this, and I don't have to feel as lonely.
Yeah. I've got a chuckle that we have Maddie working at Starbucks because I know you like to write in Starbucks. And I'm wondering if you still do that because now, you're pretty well known now. You've written quite a few books. And I wonder, do people come in going, hey, and like interrupt your process? Or, are you still doing that?
Yeah, I don't anymore. So I
Okay.
and people were interrupting it back in the day, and I
Oh,
would
they were.
always wave.
Okay.
It was fine. But I stopped during the pandemic because
All
Starbucks
right.
closed, and then I got a dog over the pandemic, and now I don't go to Starbucks because I don't want to leave my dog. So I sit at the kitchen table and set my feet.
And do you write every day? I mean, not when you're not on a book tour, obviously.
Yeah, when I front load with about 4 to 6 months of research, just pure research. And then when I start writing, the research continues, it's ongoing, especially with the people who have bipolar disorder and their families. Those conversations continue throughout. But yeah, it will, the kids go to school. I sit down to write. My goal is 1,000 to 1,500 words a day. And I start with paper and pen, and I write 3 to 5 pages stream of consciousness. I borrowed that from Julia Cameron's The Artist's Way. It's her morning pages. But I find my way into the chapter in handwriting because it feels more permissive. And then I go to the laptop, and yeah, it's every day. I try to stay in it, and I write in order from beginning to end.
Yeah, just about a minute and a half left, but I know people always want to talk about character development. Are the characters purely fictional, or are they based on people that or have interviewed for this?
No, they're purely fictional.
Yeah.
I might borrow some names here and there of people I know. If you're paying attention, I have a very good friend, Sarah Bua, and she was one of the first people who encouraged me to start writing a novel when I was, a scientist. And she and her husband Bob, Sarah and Bob, are in every book I've ever written. So you can find there's like a little Easter egg of Sarah and Bob somewhere
Okay,
in this
that's good
book.
to know. And just about 30 seconds. Still Alice became a movie, right? And was a great movie. And I know you've done a screenplay with the O'Briens. Any of your other books are they looking at to make into a
Yeah,
film?
four are in development,
Really?
and including More or Less Maddie.
Wow.
I asked if I could tell you who our actress is, but not until we have the director attached. So, like, follow me on
So
social media, and hopefully,
stand
I'll be able to
by.
announce it soon. But yeah, Every Note Played will, I think, is going to go first. But
Wow.
we have Love Neglected, Inside the O'Briens, and More or Less Maddie,
Awesome. Well,
all, yeah.
congratulations. All right, Lisa
Thank you.
Genova, author of More or Less Maddie. We'll have a link with more information at our website, capeandislands.org. Lisa, always a joy to talk to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much, Mindy.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.